terrifying.
Okay.
There was a group of sky gods. People would probably call them the Anunnaki. I would, in contemporary vernacular, speculate and say that they were the Nordics. We have a group of... They were fertility gods, but they are always represented as being half man, half fish, half man, half snake, half man, half some kind of reptile-like creature, who today they would say would be like the reptilians. There was a group of giants that were here that, you know, there actually were two groups of giants. There were the titan-like giants who were as tall as mountains and bigger than trees. Who were actually some of the progenitor-like gods. And then there was another group of giants, which is your more contemporary group, and I think the preceding culture on this planet, which were your, you know, 7 to 12-foot giant people. And then there was a group of gods that were associated with the underworld and treasures. And so, because when you read the mythology, they're described as looking physically very different.
Okay, give us an example. How did they look different?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, someone that is white and has, you know, hair and a beard would look very different than someone who was reptilian in nature versus someone who is described as a dwarf or a giant or, you know, some other characteristic.
I see. When you say they look different, you mean each of these groups look distinctively different from each other.
Correct. And they all had different agendas. And when you read mythology, they're always fighting with each other. Always. You know, it's never the sky gods fighting the sky gods. It's the sky gods fighting the fertility gods or, you know, and getting these other people involved. Because it's interesting, you know, we started talking with the Bible, and from a Christian or Judeo-Christian Western point of view, we think God is about love and, you know, He's a loving God, but when you read about the gods of myth, they're anything but loving. Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the points that we made in the book was, you know, if we want to really understand what the gods are like, all we need to do is look at ourselves, because we really don't act any different than how the gods of antiquity acted to each other.
Well, you know, I have said on the show a number of times, the subject comes up sometimes where people say, well, if they can travel across the universe to get here, they would have obviously gotten past all their warlike tendencies. Well, I don't think that's obvious at all. Better toys doesn't make better boys. We have way better technology than they had in World War I. Does that make us less warlike? Well, apparently not. We've been at war my whole life.
We've been at war since pretty much the beginning of, I mean, definitely before civilization started. You know, I just finished reading a book about Sumerian, Babylonian, and Assyrian law. And so by the time of the Sumerians, they also already had a well-developed system of slavery. I mean, slavery in their time was not like slavery in America, and so I don't want to give that impression. I mean, it was a very different, it was more like an indentured servant kind of thing. But there were these laws about if your slave runs away and, you know, if you want to sell them. And so there was this well-established custom of having slaves, you know, because it's in their legal system. So it wasn't even like, well, I think we'll get some slaves today.
So do you think, now this is a real point of departure here.
Okay.
It's a point of departure, or it's a point of establishment, one or the other. Do you think that these extraterrestrial beings that the people called gods and wrote all these stories about, do you think they existed in reality or just in the imaginations of the people?
The conclusion that I have come to is that they were, at least at some point in time, living, breathing beings. And there are a number of reasons. I mean, it's not just that I'm making it up. You know, they talk about, I've had this debate, how's that, this debate with other people on air, which is usually not very pleasant. But I know I'm not going to have a problem with you, Kevin, so it's all good. Many people believe that the gods were figments of our imaginations, or they were describing the weather. And in the same breath, they say, well, you know, those people, they were primitive, and they, you know, had to have this stuff to explain the reality of life. And then I'll turn around and say, well, if they were smart enough to build the pyramids and some of these other megalithic structures around the world, don't you think they would be smart enough to recognize something that was right in front of their face? One point. One of the things that's interesting, and it's a topic that I'm actually working on exploring right now, is in antiquity, the people were very clear that the gods were one thing and ghosts were another. You know, they understood that ghosts were ethereal, you know, and they were in a different category. But there aren't any ghost stories that took a ghost and immortalized it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then there's the whole idea about the things that they did, the technology that they had, you know, the flying chariots, the, you know, they say it was a lightning bolt, but you find this weapon that shoots out, you know, like a high energy laser beam around the world. I mean, it's not just Zeus that has it, you know, in the stories. And they explained it the best they could with, you know, the information that they had and the knowledge that they had. And I don't know how they could have made up something. I mean, today we have science fiction. We have the myths to draw on to come up with stories. But back then, you know, why aren't there stories about the gods plowing fields or doing things that were people-like? Because they're never that way.
Yeah, well, you know, I also have done this before, and that is people cannot draw what they haven't seen.
Exactly.
They can draw variations on what they've seen, but you can't draw what you haven't seen. And I've done this little experiment. I tell people to get out a pencil and paper and draw me a picture, and I make up a word. One picture was draw me a picture of a flammaflige. Well, go ahead, you know. You can't, because you never saw one.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I think that while the stories may have some embellishments, and look, it would be foolish to think that they don't have embellishments. Look at the embellishments that have gone on with Bible stories. And you know, you've got the Bible, and it says what it says, and then there are people that add details that are not there, you know, and come up with, you know, more incredible versions of these stories. So it happens with the Bible. It would happen with all of these stories that they are telling about these beings that they encountered. Do we have... One of the problems we have, Dr. Louise, is we go back to the ancient anybody, ancient Egyptians, ancient Sumerians, doesn't matter, pick a group. At the time they were living, there were people known to them as ancient to them. But if we go back as far as the records go, do any of the records take us back to face-to-face confrontation or meeting with these beings from off-planet?
It's a very different kind of relationship once we get into, you know, what I call late mythology. I consider anything, I'm going to say, pre-flood, you know, the flood and anything earlier, as being ancient mythology and then late mythology, because there's a real shift, and there's a couple of different points I'd like to make, but I'll start here. There's a real shift in the narrative line. The early myths, The stories are the stories of the gods about the gods. You know, and one of the conclusions that we feel very strongly about is that these very early myths, which are universal, you find these same stories around the globe, were actually the stories of the gods that they told about themselves and shared with humanity. When you move into the later myths, they tend to be a little more localized. You know, when we get into the stories of the demigods, Perseus and Hercules, they tend to be more localized, and the role that the god plays in the story tends to be more distant. You know, the gods are on Mount Olympus, as opposed to being the main character in the story. The main characters are no longer the gods, they are mankind. And so when we read stories of Enoch ascending into the heaven and walking with God and learning from the angels, you know, most people's knee-jerk reaction is, oh, well, you know, they just made that up. Mm-hmm. You know, and so there are stories that talk about humanity and mankind interacting with the God. I mean, I think that the story of Moses on the top of Mount Sinai is an ET encounter par none.
Oh, I would agree. And, of course, there are people whose opinion about that is, well, no, wait a minute, that was no ET, that's God. Well, folks, is God from here? If he's not from here, this is Terra. That's the name of this planet, Terra. If he's not from Terra, if he didn't come from here, then he's from off Terra, extra Terra, extraterrestrial. And so definitely you have a meeting between Moses and God up on the mountain recorded in the Bible. That is ET encounter for sure.
I'm going to throw a little monkey wrench into this whole thing, and I'm going to pre-state this because we just don't know. You know, from the mythological record, we just don't know. And I'm sure you've done some shows about the contemporary reptilian agenda and how they talk about, well, we've been on the planet, you know, for forever, and this is our planet, and the dinosaurs went underground. I don't know. It's an area that I've kind of touched on, but I'm definitely not an expert on. And when you read the myths, you know, okay, there definitely
we have to take a break. I want you to hold that thought, though, because when we come back, I want to pick up right there with the whole reptilian thing.
Okay. All right.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Dr. Rita Louise, and we are discussing her book called Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods. You were about to get into something about reptilians, I believe, but then the break took over. So, Dr. Louise, the mic is yours.
Okay. One of the things that seemed consistent, I mean, there were so many consistencies that we found through mythology, you know, but taking it back, there is the question of, have they been here for a really long time because they were here terraforming the planet and then just never went home, so to speak? You know, so would they, you know, that's where we get the question, are they really extraterrestrials? And I'll explain what I mean. So what we learn in mythology is that there were a group of eight beings, and I'm totally summarizing here, that we're inside of what has been called the cosmic egg. We hear about this cosmic egg or this egg or something like an egg around the world. And like the Dogon, for example, talk about eight individuals, male-female pairs, a very consistent theme, that traveled in an ark and came to the Earth from Sirius, as a matter of fact. And these beings were half man, half fish. But that narrative is very consistent. Now, from that progenitor group, they had a number of children. And it is unclear whether the groups that we're dealing with are the offspring of this original group, especially the reptilians, you know, or the reptile-like race, mm-hmm. because they seem to be the ones that were here on the Earth first. They're the ones that we believe did the terraforming here on Earth, the fertility gods. See, I don't like calling them reptilians because it brings in too much contemporary stuff, you know, so I tend to call them the fertility gods because they're mm-hmm. always represented as a man or a snake, like Quetzalcoatl is a fertility god, Enki, fertility god. You know, and so there are always these characteristics attributed to them. One of the things that we do feel fairly strongly about, although we can't really say we have clarity, is that the sky gods, the ones that we're kind of assigning to the Nordics, were a group that came in and took control. You know, so whether they were from, you know, an offspring from this progenitor race, or whether they were a group that came in and fought a war and won, basically. Mm-hmm. Well, not basically, exactly. I mean, because that's, it's really hard to tell, you know, but there are the people that are, you know, that talk about the reptilians don't want to give up control of the Earth because, you know, because they were here first and, you know, they've always been here. Mythology kind of supports that claim, you know? I just think it's very interesting how there are so many things that are coming out from modern ufology. Now, whether they are basing it on mythological areas or if it's coming from somewhere else, I don't know.
Well, but you know, the thing is, though... All right. There could be this sort of thing involved as well, I think. Let me throw it out and see what you think about it. My general appearance, I look German. I mean, it's pretty easy to tell I'm German or I'm Celtic. It's not easy to tell that I'm also Cherokee, but I am. And some other things, okay? But it's the look I have is primarily German. I've never lived in Germany. If someone were to ask me, are you German? The answer is, no, I'm not. I'm from here, okay? And so with this progenitor group, and they have offspring, their offspring are terrestrial. They're from here. So maybe
exactly.
Maybe that's what's all involved in clouding the issue.
Exactly. You know, and that is the concern, you know, but most people, you know, and I'm going to say something, please no mean cards, the letters to me or Kevin, you know, but we are, as a culture, are so egocentric, you know, we're the center of the universe, you know, the sun revolves around the Earth. And when you read these stories and they talk about these characters, we automatically assume they're talking about us, that they're talking about humanity as it exists in the present moment. And I think that's one of the assumptions that needs to be put to the side and not thought that way. You know, because I think a lot of these stories are actually talking about creatures that were not us.
And what you just described, I coined a word for it. We are homo terracentric. We are homo terracentric. Now, I'm talking about now. In this present age, we're homo terracentric in the way we look at everything. And with homo terracentric eyes, we look back into these myths, and that also clouds the issue. Because we don't understand them with the same frame of mind that the people at that time understood them.
Exactly. I mean, I do believe that there was a group of gods that came from somewhere else mm-hmm. and terraformed this planet. I truly believe that because the stories... I mean, there's this one story that I think is Cherokee, and they talk about these people, you know, being in these cocoons... You know, trapped in the void, and inside these cocoons were all the things that you needed to have life. I mean, I'm sorry, what would you do with that? If somebody said, oh, yeah, you know, we started because at one point in time, we, you know, all of humanity and all of the plants and all the trees and all the things to have life were in this cocoon. And then it rested for a really long time until the planet was ready for it to open. And when it opened, everything came out. Mm. I mean, what do you do with something like that?
Well, you know what? let me tell you what I do with that. There are very real plans. Now, whether they'll ever be carried out is another issue. But there are very real plans made by very real scientists backed by very serious money to terraform Mars. And these plans, some of these plans include sending, if you will, cocoons, pods of supplies and water and plants to Mars to pre-position those as they begin terraforming using robot technology. And when everything is ready, then they send the human crew and the pods open and they're able to plant and grow and everything is wonderful. Or as the old song says, everything is beautiful in its own way. So they're describing doing what you just described.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I believe that, you know, and people get really hung up, and I'm going to kind of shift gears here a second, about the whole idea of these gods genetically manipulating DNA. But if you think about it, we do that now.
Yep.
We have GMOs. You know, mm-hmm. We have Bessie the clone sheep.
We also now have synthetic DNA.
Ew.
Yeah, they have mastered the way to synthesize and make DNA. And I'm interested really too in the term gods, because I don't think there are any. I'm not saying I don't think there is God. That's not what I'm not an atheist. But I certainly would not define God as most religions do. But these so-called gods, I think they're just people. Maybe a whole different species of people, but they're just people that had better toys. They had better technology. They arrived here and did things that were amazing to whatever was here. Or maybe there was no one here, and so they did genetic engineering, and here we are. And then we were amazed that they could do all these things we can't do. Well, these days we can do them. And a lot of those amazing things we can do, and we are doing.
You know, it's also the spin that we have on the word God.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about it, there's gods, and then you get the whole dogma and the whole religious concept into the whole thing. Well, you know, you want to make the gods be more important.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back, and in this next hour, we will be opening up the telephones. So be listening and watching. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and to my guest, Dr. Rita Louise. And for those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. We're delighted you're here. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from us for the first hour. But you also have my sincere hopes, prayers, dreams, best energies toward this, that you never suffer that tragedy again. And during the first hour, we've been discussing a book by Dr. Rita Louise, and the book is called Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods. And so we've been looking at this whole concept about these myths, so-called myths, about extraterrestrial gods. And as we went away for break, Dr. Louise, you were just about to address that whole issue of, you know, gods.
Oh, I'm like, let's see. I kind of had a space out moment during the break, and
well, you were what you were about to address is that when we use this word gods, what happens is people automatically these days wrap all kinds of whole dogma and stuff around it.
Right. Well, one of the things that we find in mythology is that, you know, there was, I tend to call him the father god, who, according to many myths, talk about that he had actually walked the earth at one point in time and then, you know, went back to wherever he was. So if you are talking like Zachariah Sitchin, we would be talking about like Anu. Uh-huh. And they hadn't seen him for a long time, but he was the guy in charge. And I think one of the things that has happened is that the concept of that god got blended in with the concept of the creator god, the energy, the consciousness, you know, the big G god that, no, I can't explain, and I'm not going to try, that, you know, originated this world, you know, on whatever level it is, you know, because it's something that no one can explain at this point in time. But we also find that same pattern of things being consolidated together. For example, in the Hindu tradition, they have really five different homes of gods. There are four primary groups that interact on the earth, and then this one more ethereal sphere where the father god lives. But in other cultures, the number gets smaller. So, for example, in Greek mythology, they only have a pantheon of three primary gods. The gods of the north, the ones that are the builders, the ones that are usually associated with the giants, the El giants, the ones that are associated with the ability to do craftsmanship and make the tools and the weapons and build these things, they kind of disappear, you know, because they're put into a more subordinate role. I don't really know. In other mythologies, the god of the water, in Greek it would be Poseidon, mixes with the god of the underworld. That's why it's interesting, because the fertility gods are always associated with water. Always. Now, entrance into their underwater realm, according to myth, can be accessed through a cave, in the same way you can access into the underworld via a cave. And I think that the personalities and the personas of those two gods, those two lineages of gods, mm-hmm. quote unquote, have gotten merged together. So we end up with somebody like the devil. You know, so the devil, because the fertility gods are usually associated with being the trickster gods, like Loki, fertility god, mm-hmm. Enki, fertility god. And so, you know, and with the devil, you know, he steers you off course. But the devil's also associated with the dead, which is the god of the underworld, more of your Hades kind of god. And so depending on the culture, you might have this, you know, shrinking of these groups of gods because they've gotten combined. And so when we're talking about the big G god, the big creator god, I think our understanding of that god got combined with the father god, the Anu god, who had been here at one point in time, but has not been seen for a very long time.
All right. What we're going to do at this moment is we are going to invite our audience to join the conversation. And we do that by opening the telephone lines. The telephone number is 623-444-5889. 623-444-5889. And, of course, we also would like to hear from those of you who live outside the USA and outside of Canada. And you can do that by calling us, or you can send us a flash message. If you're in the USA or Canada, please give us a call. And this would be a great night for first-time callers. If we've never heard from you before, tonight's your night. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Sorry, Kevin. This is Brent from Wyoming.
Are you going to live?
Yeah, I'll live.
Okay.
Rita, you did mention the Greek pantheon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you by chance go to Greece and visit with some of their elders or whatever? Because according to Jerry Wills, who has been there, the Greek gods, they talk to what we call their mythology is their history. They know they're extraterrestrials. I'm wondering if you also know anything about the fact that when they were digging a subway in Athens, I think it was Athens, mm-hmm. they dug up a vault filled with giant skeletons.
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, I had not heard that. I mean, I believe that, you know, the mythology that we call mythology was their history, you know, of whatever culture it is. It's just us and our pigheadedness that says, oh, you know, it's just these stories. I don't think it's just those stories. And we did not delve into specific archaeological sites, you know, so we didn't look at the pyramids. You know, somebody complained because I didn't write about Atlantis. But to be honest with you, there was only one story of Atlantis, and we could not find corroborating myths. You know, and so that was one of the big things that we looked for. We would not include a storyline in the book if we could not find a parallel myth somewhere else. And I'm not talking about, well, the Greeks have a story and the Sumerians have a story because, you know, geographically speaking, they're right on top of each other. We're talking about, well, the Greeks have a story and we find a parallel myth in South America. So.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. I had forgotten about that. The associate host of this show that covers for me if I can't be here is Jerry Wills, and Jerry was in Greece, was it last year or year before? Year before, I guess. And the people that he met there, their attitude about what we call mythology is, that's not mythology, that's our history, you know?
Well, and I think we put this in the book, you know, because it was one of those, do you put this controversial little, like, slap in it, or do you leave the slap out? And I can't remember if we left it in, because it was definitely something my husband would have put in. But the book is really written for the Western world, for the Judeo-Christian world that has been totally brainwashed from our true history. If you go to India and if you go to China, there is definitely, or the Americas, there definitely is a belief that these sky people came down here and engineered us and did this stuff. It's only in, you know, the Bible-thumping societies that we have lost that history. And I'm very happy to hear that the Greeks still accept their mythology as history. I think that's wonderful to hear.
Well, yeah. And after all, it is we, the rest of us out here, who have decided that these stories are myth. You see? I mean, just because we call it myth does not mean it is.
Exactly. Like I said, you know, there is this big-headedness that exists and has existed. It's interesting. You know, you read some of these chronicles of the Spanish when they came into the New World, and they looked at the indigenous cultures and, you know, basically went in and said, yep, everything you're doing is wrong.
Yeah.
And the attitude really hasn't changed. It's like, well, we decided that that's all false, so it doesn't matter. They're myths. It's false. It's not true.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in the book. Like, okay.
Yeah.
Everybody else is talking about it except you.
Let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, Kevin. It's Lasha from Vancouver.
Hello, Lasha.
Sorry to phone in after being a guest on your show so so recently, but I've got a big monkey wrench for you on this one, Kevin.
Throw it.
You know, I've been trained as a poet.
Okay.
And I've been trained very deeply as a mystic, and uh-huh. I understand mythology, and I've studied the classics quite extensively.
Before you go any further, let me ask Lasha, before you go any further.
Yes.
Before we get into that, how do you know it's mythology and not about real beings?
Oh, it absolutely is real beings, and I can explain how.
Okay.
What mythology is, we have to remember, it's instructive. Myths instruct us about things. Mm-hmm. That's their purpose. And we have to understand that metaphor is how these people spoke in ancient times. When we talk about the 12 gods, we're talking about the 12 different realms, okay? This universe is built on 12 different dimensions. It's based on the number 12.
Okay.
When we're talking about the different gods that are like in the pod, and they're close to the number 7 or 8 or 9, we're talking about the chakra system.
How do you know
okay?
that? How do you know?
Because that's what the stories mean.
How do you know
they're
that?
Ways of instructing, spiritual instruction.
Well, okay, I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm asking, so who told you that? I mean what's the source of knowing, pardon me, that that's the case?
Well, I didn't read in any book because it's never been written in a book.
Uh-huh.
But what I do is I look at the metaphors of it. I understand what a metaphor is, and I know what it means to the psyche, and I can feel it.
But
Let me throw something in, Kevin. You know, there is a understanding in most cultures, you know, as above, so below. And I do think that many of the materials that come to us from antiquity are so right on. But I'm going to have a caveat here. It doesn't make sense to me that the same story with the same characters, with the same numbers, would extend around the world with the same message.
Well, that makes
you know, there's a big difference between, well, you know, there's a difference between when you look at the chakra system in Hinduism and you look at the Kabbalah in Judaism. Now, I believe that they came from the same source, you know, but they were deviated from each other. And there's a big enough difference, and even though geographically speaking, they're not that far from each other, but there's a big enough difference that most people can't see that they are really the same system looked at from two different perspectives. But we find closer similarities in myths around the world than we find in those two philosophical traditions that grew up hand in hand next to each other.
Well, now let me throw something in, and then I want to hear what you have to say about it, Lasha. You know I write lyrics for music, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I have had people tell me what those lyrics mean to them, and I'm amazed. It's not that I think they're wrong. It's that I never thought of that, you know. But those lyrics speak to them in that way. And you know, I get email and I read it and they tell me, you know, when you talked about this, I could just see blah 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 blah, and I'm thinking like, really? Okay, that was
not
cool.
What you meant?
It's not that I did not mean it. It's just that I was talking about something else. But if it means that to them, okay. And isn't it possible that very real things could also have a metaphorical meaning to us in our time?
Absolutely. But I think what we have to realize is we're talking about archetypes. They're a little bit more...
Everybody wants to go to that archetype thing. And
pardon me?
You know, everybody wants to go to that archetype thing. And it's interesting because I was having a conversation with someone the other day, and we were talking about... They were talking about the appearance of horns in some sculpture, and then we got talking about the burrows in England and Ireland and about these cow horns. And it's interesting because there is this tradition of sacred cows that we find around the world, and we find in mythology, and they're associated with sacrifice. And, you know, why a cow? Why is there a cow in Australia? Why is there a cow or some kind of bovine in England? You know, why isn't it a kangaroo or a squirrel? You know, and there's no cows in archetypes. You know, and we're talking about that level of detail. You know, the lightning bolt that Zeus holds, we find a very parallel weapon being held by Vishnu. I mean, it's beyond these general principles. It gets down to some very specific details in very divergent cultures.
To the ancient people, cows were where milk came from, which was the same as what a woman did to a child. They gave them milk, which is about the female principle, which is about the sign Cancer, which is about the moon, which is what those horns represent.
Okay.
That's where the...
Okay, I think the two of you have to agree to disagree.
I don't mean to be argumentative. That's not what I intend.
No, you're presenting your views, and we understand that. I think that, and this will maybe both of you will disagree with, but I think that, for instance, with the horns, somewhere somebody saw some extraterrestrial that had horns and did wonderful and powerful things and said they had an oh my God moment. And so then they probably started sacrificing cows to that god and thought it would be a good thing. I mean, I'm just making this up as I go. But, I mean, I can see that
but
sort
it's
of...
it's a pretty good one.
Yeah, well, I can see that kind of pattern happening.
I have to jump in on that because I can tell you from a meditative experience, at a certain level of mysticism, you actually see two circles coming together that look like horns. That's where the two eyes become one, and okay. It looks like that when you're in deep meditation. That's part of where that image comes from as well.
Maybe. But then again, the ancient people might not have been meditating. They might have been scratching.
Good morning, folks. Much respect.
I think they were meditating, and I think they knew a great deal more than... I think they're trying to tell us that in the stories.
Well,
about
maybe,
the journeys
well,
that you need to take
maybe.
In order to understand the human journey.
You might be right. It's possible.
I could be wrong. I'm not saying that I'm right, but that's been my feeling of it.
Mm-hmm. I think while it may have become meditative, the origin is more physical and observant.
Yeah, we certainly find evidence of it. Of those symbols in the world, yeah, absolutely.
All right, I'm going to move on, but thanks for the call.
Okay, thanks, Kevin.
All right, bye-bye. You know, I guess I'm kind of the black sheep, you know. Whether we're talking about Christianity or if we're talking about Judaism or if we're talking about any of the flavors of any of that, you know, like Catholicism or Protestants or what. I'm always kind of the black sheep, and I'm that way with the mystical stuff too, in that I think almost everything that is today religious or mystical had a very physical, real beginning that was less and perhaps not even religious or mystical. And that the mysticism and the religion grew up after that.
And I don't necessarily disagree with you.
Mm-hmm.
There are, I mean, my background, Kevin, as you know, is working in the woo-woo world. I work as a medical intuitive. I teach people how to develop their psychic abilities. I mean, that's the world that I come out of.
Mm-hmm.
And And when you read, I mean, one of the, my early experiences is, you know, I like reading those old dry, dusty books that sit in people's libraries, you know. So I've studied the chakras, I've studied Kabbalah, you know, and a lot of the ancient traditions. And when you look at a lot of the ancient Hindu traditions, they're, it's pretty clearly very spiritual, esoteric, about, you know, raising your vibration. I mean, I'm not going to disagree with that. And there's part of me that feels like those people were taught, you know, that information, because it comes in when, even with some of these ancient spiritual traditions, they come in kind of fully developed.
So
kind
you
of
think
like
they were
Sumerian
taught that,
civilization.
You think they were taught that then by these extraterrestrials, maybe?
Or the pre-existing reptilian race or whatever, you know?
Well, then you're still talking about a face-to-face contact then.
I think that there were people that were pulled aside and downloaded information to, you know, like your Enoch-type person.
Okay, I don't disagree with that, but that's still, at that point, a physical face-to-face confrontation.
Oh, exactly, exactly.
And then all the religious and mystical stuff grows up around that event that was a very real physical event.
But, you know, one of the, I'm working on a new article,
mm-hmm.
and I'll share it with the listeners, and the working title is Ghost, Gods, and Myths. And one of the things that I started looking at, you know, I mentioned earlier that the people understood and recognized and saw the gods as being something. And they believe in ghosts, kind of, but there's this level of skepticism. And there's definitely a recognition that ghosts aren't, quote unquote, real.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense, you know, I mean, it's basically what we think about them today, you know, mm-hmm. they're ghosts.
All right, look, we have to step away for a break, so we'll have to catch the rest of that on the other side. Don't forget it, though, and we'll be back on the other side of the break. Caller, are you willing to hang on through the break?
Yes.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we do have to step away for a break, and we're going to do that. My guest this evening is Dr. Rita Louise, and we are talking about her book, Man-Made, The Chronicles of Our Extraterrestrial Gods. We'll be back right after this. All right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest. And you were about to make a point, Dr. Louise, so go ahead with that. And caller, we'll get to you right after that.
All right. I'll be quick. You know, but you were talking about these stories you feel are documenting real encounters, and then we've just created this theology and dogma around them.
Mm-hmm.
And what was really interesting that I uncovered, because it just really bothered me that the ghosts were kind of over there, but the gods were good. Anyway, one of the things that I found interesting was with the concept of death rituals. So, I mean, when somebody dies, there is, you know, they're buried and we have the mourning. And in Egypt and in cultures around the world, they're interred with grave goods, et cetera, et cetera. And the point of giving them the grave goods and doing these rituals around them being dead is so that they, quote unquote, journey to the next world peacefully. True?
That is what they
say. That's pretty much what you hear.
Yeah.
However, when you start digging into ancient traditions and really looking at, like, indigenous cultures, you know, the Philippines, the Australians, the Native Americans, they want them to travel peaceably to the other side, because if they don't, they come back as a ghost. That's their belief. Now, that's a very interesting twist that we in the Western world don't really think about. And where it really got interesting, which I think supports your point, Kevin, is that the earliest intentional burials that we have on record, that there is, you know, archaeological evidence for, are 130,000 years old and go back to Neanderthal and early human burials, where they were put into a fetal position, covered with ochre, and given grave goods 130,000 years ago, and we are still doing the same thing today.
All right. Let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Rusty from Michigan.
Hello, Rusty.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Louise.
Hi, Rusty.
Hi. You know, you have this knowledge about the ancient beings, and what good does that do us today? I mean, you know, what benefit is that from knowing this knowledge? I mean, it is interesting, of course, you know, that's why I listen to this show, but what is it really going to do for us?
You know, good question. Reading.
do we need to know because the gods are coming back, or, I mean...
Well, let me throw what I... This is my view of it. Let me throw this out. We have people doing today... You're a pretty religious guy, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so you have a lot of respect for the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
You got people coming out of seminaries doing exactly the same crap to the Bible that's been done to these extraterrestrial encounters. And they will tell you that things that are recorded as a historical statement in the Bible, well, this is just an allegory that teaches us this, this, and this. Now, my statement about that is, hang on a second. It either is true or that's a lie. It's just that simple. That either happened. I'm going to give you an example. There's a king by the name of Og at Bashan who he gets assassinated. And it tells about his bedstead. He had an iron bedstead. And I forget how... I'm going to make up a number because I don't remember the number, but it's like 13 feet long. He was a giant. And they will say, well, you know, this is allegorical because he was so prominent and so well thought of. That's why they describe him as being a giant. Now, that's crap. It's either he is a giant, as it is recorded, or that's a lie. It's not allegorical. Because it's made as a statement of fact. And so what happens is, you've heard me say it, Rusty, that all theology is fiction.
Uh-huh.
What grows up is all of these flowery theological statements about this is an allegory, that's an allegory, this teaches us that, this teaches us that. You know what? It either... When it makes a statement that's supposed to be a statement of fact, that's either the truth or that's a lie. And all that theological crap is fiction. Now, if we can see that these things are true, that there's a basis of truth in these myths about these ancient so-called gods, And that there's been a lot of stories built up around them and embellishments and so forth around them, it kind of helps you protect yourself against that happening to you in the current day because you're watching it happen. You know, it's happening in church after church across the world every single Sunday.
Okay.
That's
you know, and I'm going to kind of just... piggyback on that, you know, when you look at the Sumerian tablets, and I'm going to use them as a very specific example, there are thousands of Sumerian tablets, but the bulk of them are Sumerian legal tablets and Sumerian tablets that are documenting inventories and things that a company would need to keep running kind of thing, you know, but they're definitely like work products. And thrown in the midst of these, we find these epic tales like the Epic of Gilgamesh or the Enumelu Elish. Now, why spend the time to write down these narratives if they weren't important to them and they were something that they wanted to preserve like a legal document for posterity if they were a piece of science fiction?
makes sense.
Rusty, before I think you probably have another question, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Before we get to that, before we leave this, you've heard me say there is the Bible, and then there's what all these theologians say that thing says. Well, you're not stupid. You can read, and you can read what it says, and it says some fantastic things that the modern mind says, oh, that just can't be. One of the things it said, it says in there, is all about these people called the Hittites. And when I was growing up, early in my life, up until the early ages of my life, theologians and scientists were saying, there's no such thing as the Hittites. They never existed. They never existed. Meanwhile, what was going on from the late 1800s up into the early 1900s and was going on right up into my early life, they had been discovered, and their language was being deciphered. And as it turns out, they were one of the great empires on Earth. And they're located into what today we call Turkey. They found the palace. The foundation of the palace is 25 acres. King David's palace is about 1 acre.
Wow, that's something.
So here we have a statement of fact that all the theologians were teaching up until fairly recent times. This was allegorical. It was not real. It, you know, and my position is on any document, if it makes a statement of faith, it's either a statement of fact, it's either the truth, or it's a lie. One or the other.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dr. Louise, when you did your research there, was there something in those myths that spoke of when the gods were coming back?
They did not talk about that. What you do learn from several references is that they have come here. I mean, it does seem pretty clear that, one, they didn't really live on the surface of the earth. That when mankind was formed, that they only interacted with them on a number of occasions. And we find this coming from Mesoamerican sources, South American sources, and Sumerian sources primarily. And so I'm going to use the Sumerian source from Berosus. He talks about these Onas, these half-men, half-fish, that came out of the water and taught mankind a number of different things. And the first time the Onas came out of the water was about 300-something thousand years ago. And they came out of the water two other times after the flood. One of the things that he says was that they didn't know if it was the same guy, because it had been such a long time since one of these creatures appeared. But it had the same characteristics. It was the half man, half fish. And then these Onas came three times after the flood. In South America, you hear that Viracocha went and taught mankind, and then at some point in time, Viracocha comes back, but he's actually described as being a beggar and was kicked out of cities and was shunned. But they didn't realize who he was, and so the people that were actually kind to him received his riches, and not necessarily the monetary riches, but his riches in a bigger picture. You know, and so there are these stories that they make these regular visits, and so, you know, are they coming back because they're going to come by tomorrow to visit? You know, kind of shifting the perspective because they make regular visits. And, I mean, I definitely think they're going to come back, you know. But where we see the last, and I'm going to say major download of information from the gods is with the rise of civilization. I mean, we see these blurps that happen. in time where we like make this major advance. And in my opinion, you know, that's when we have these visitations and there's a new infusion of information into society. And, you know, chronologically speaking, and I'm going to be very conservative about this, you know, we're talking about 3500 BC, you know, 4500 BC, beginning of Sumerian, very advent of Egyptian culture. But in the time of the gods, in their timeline, we're only talking a little over 5,000 years. It's really not that big. Not when they measure things in thousands of years.
Can I get one more quick one, Kevin?
Sure, go ahead.
In your research, Kent, is there anything in the myths that show man becoming as the gods?
Great question. No one's asked me that question. That's a great question. In the mythology, the way mankind... Okay, were you listening to the first hour of the show?
Yeah.
Rusty?
Yeah.
So where I was talking about the early myths and then the later myths.
Yeah.
And so this is talking directly toward the early myths, where it's the gods talking about the gods and the creation of man. And... when the gods relate to or refer to man, they kind of talk to him or talk about him as kind of like my dog who's trying to talk right now.
Okay, tell you what, we have to take a break.
Okay.
And so what we'll do is take the break. Rusty, just listen and you'll get that answer when we come back.
All righty, thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, we do have to step away for a break, and we'll be back. We'll take more of your calls after this. All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Dr. Rita Louise. Rusty had asked you, is there anything in your research that talks about us becoming like the gods? And you were about to answer, and the break took over.
Right. In most of the more ancient texts, the ones where the gods are talking about themselves, mankind is often looked at or discussed as like we would think of our dog or our cat. You know, in Sumerian texts, and I think this is really kind of like the ultimate insult, you know, they're the black-headed people, you know, but they're like this group that's over there that do not have the same rights and the same level of authority as the gods. Now, with that said, and I can't remember, I think it was Aztec, I think it was a Mesoamerica culture, or maybe like the Popol Vuh, but it was definitely Mesoamerica. And there's a myth that comes out of there, and this is the only one that actually speaks to that subject specifically, is that when they created the current version of man, because there were multiple iterations to create mankind as we exist today. You know, so whether they're talking about Neanderthals and, you know, Australopithecines, we don't really know. But in the current version, you know, we were the final byproduct of their genetic engineering. But there is this one story that came out that talks about when they finally created this being that wasn't stupid and could walk and could do all of the things that they wanted it to be able to do, they were too smart and they were too open intuitively, and they somehow shut that down. But they knew that over time that we would regain that intelligence and begin to recognize where we had come from.
Well, and perhaps that is the case right now. You know, the interesting thing, I didn't want us to get into Genesis too deeply, because then you're getting into people's theology and dogma, and everybody already knows that I'm pretty much the black sheep on that. There is sort of a parallel in Genesis. Everybody thinks Adam and Eve got kicked out of the garden because they sinned, because that's what their theologians told them. But if they would read Genesis, it says why they got kicked out. And it says, "And the Lord God said, now the man has become one of us, and lest he reach forth his hand and take of the tree of life," not the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that's what they said Eve and Adam ate off of, "but lest they take reach forth their hand and take of the tree of life, they must go from the garden." And so it says why? It says because now we had become one of them. What are them? Well, according to Genesis, their species is called Elohim. And at least three times in the Bible, we are referred to as Elohim, not as humans, as Elohim. And this sticks in the craw of theologians. They don't want to talk about it. But the point is this. The parallel here is the ability to be that smart.
Exactly. Well, and what's interesting is that there are parallel myths that you find around the world about this prohibition of eating the foods of the gods. You know, some of them talk to the point of, like, if you go into the underworld, you know, because you're looking for the soul of somebody and they offer you something to eat, don't eat it because you'll never get to come back. You know, we have the story of, can't remember the name of the specific myth, but Enki's son creates a little bit of disturbance. He stops the winds from blowing, and now they can't sail their ships. And so he gets called up to see the big god, Anu, and his father tells him, if they offer you something to eat, don't eat it. If they offer you something to drink, don't drink it. And this was a mortal son. So this son did not have godlike powers. And so he did not do that. But if he had, he would have gained immortality and been like a god. And so why his father told him not to do it, I don't know.
Well, it is a mind bender, to say the least, to start trying to figure out these people, these beings that ancient people referred to, or at least we say they referred to them as gods, and they did, referred to them as gods. I still don't think they are. I think they are extraterrestrials that have better toys. And ancient people looked at them and said, wow, that must be a god. But I'll tell you how easily you can become a god. All you have to do is take one of those stun guns, not a taser, but one of those that the public can buy, a stun gun, where you just touch somebody and zap them and they hit the ground. If you could travel in time and take that back 100 years, 200, you'd be more of a god. Take it back 500 years, and you could rule the earth.
Exactly. In the same breath, you know, if you look at the dynamics of like a parent-child relationship, especially a very young child, you know, that child looks up to their parent like they are God. You know, and so there is definitely this role of humanity being submissive and subservient to this group that has the really good technology. You know, in this looking up, you're going to take care of us way. And I think that adds to the whole thing because we were very dependent on them. Or it does seem that way.
I think our species thought we were more dependent than we actually were.
Exactly.
And I think that still exists. And you know, I catch it from the woo-woos. I catch it from the straight UFO, not woo-woos. I catch it from the religious people. I'm the outcast from everyone. Nevertheless, I stand where I stand. And I think that a whole lot of what people refer to as the gods, is just better technology. And, you know, I mean, somebody could show up right now with the ability to just point his hand at you and turn you into ash because of some technology he's got. Well, he turns somebody into ash, and then he looks at you and he says, "Now tell me, am I God?" And you say, "No." Zap, ash. He looks at the next person. "You tell me, am I God?" "Yes, indeed."
But, you know, there's that TV show Stargate, mm-hmm. and I think that I loved the representation, you know, especially of Apophis. He was one of my favorites.
Okay, we only have about 30 seconds here.
Okay, he was very godlike, and if you put him back into the time period that he supposedly reigned, you know, back into that early Egypt, he would have been a god, and he was a snake.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm shutting up.
Dr. Rita Louise, thank you so much for being our guest. Where can people go to get your book?
Okay, there's a number of different ways. They can go to my website, which is www.soulhealer.com. That's kind of the gateway to everything Rita Louise. So I have that, the man-made book, as well as all of my other books on there. Actually, I have a tour to Peru coming up in June. And so if people want to join myself and Brian Forrester in Peru, it's going to be really exciting, Kevin. We're going to be doing some remote viewing work down there. And Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, your major retailers, everywhere. It's everywhere.
All right, stay on the line with me for a moment as I bring this one in for a close. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Rita Louise. Somebody shows up and says they are a god. Be very, very careful. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.